There was an earthquake last night that was felt in Fairbanks, Palmer, and Anchorage, and especially in McKinley Park. Steve Estes, research associate at the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks, explains.
At 5:46 last evening, there was an earthquake in the McKinley Park vicinity. It registered 5.3 on the Richter scale.
Now, when you say McKinley Park vicinity, what does this mean?
Well, probably about 10 miles south of Cantwell. The earthquake itself was located approximately 60 miles deep. It was a very deep earthquake.
Wow.
Typically, those types of earthquakes don't have any aftershocks associated with them, so I wouldn't expect any.
5.3, you said, on the Richter scale? That's quite high, isn't it?
Well, it's comparable to the ones that did a fair amount of damage in California earlier this year, late last year, in Livermore, California, where the radiation lab suffered damage. And in Santa Barbara, just over a year ago, there was an earthquake that caused damage to overpasses and highways and things like that. It's roughly the same size.
Was this earthquake at all anticipated?
No. However, I would expect earthquakes like that to happen again and again and again in that vicinity. It's associated with the big structure of the earth and plate tectonics.
As far as Estes knows, there is no visible sign of the quake, no gaping hole in the earth.
Our instruments picked it up, and I did have talk to some people at McKinley Park who felt it, and another person in the Cantwell area who felt it. They said that they felt the building. One late woman said the whole building shook, and the gentleman at McKinley Park said it just was one big sharp jolt. But they didn't know of any damage that occurred.
Steve Estes of the Geophysical Institute. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Love letter. It snows now even when the sun is out. The day your letter came, I stayed inside all day. My hair is growing long. The dog has had her puppies, we gave them away. Mondays I teach. Every goddamn time I pass the place, I think of you. My dear, what can I say to you at such a distance?
Mary Barron, professor of English at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, has published two books of poetry. The first, entitled Letters from the New England Dead, and the second, just out, Wheat Among the Bones. I asked her why she writes.
In order to survive, in order to find out who I am and who I'm going to become tomorrow, I often find my poems know what's going on before I do. I don't write poems as finished products, having already figured out what I'm going to say. I start writing a poem in order to find out where the language will lead me, and often it leads me into areas of myself I haven't explored before.
Most of your poems are about yourself, is that right?
Yes.
Have you ever tried writing poems about other things, external things?
To some extent, what I do more often is write in dialogue. The title poem for my first book, Letters for the New England Dead, is a poem which talks to and about and back and forth with dead New England poets whose poems stimulated me. And that's a way of creating another self, setting up a poem so that you're both you and Emily Dickinson at the same time.
If you could be, would you want to be Emily Dickinson?
I'm not sure if that's worth it, even for the poems.
Barron has been writing poetry for nearly 10 years. That's not including her attempts while in high school. She wrote fiction for a time, then dropped out of college, had a daughter, and went back to poetry.
While I was out of school and feeling completely isolated in Flushing, New York, in desperation, I started writing poems again. Nothing else would do. Stories wouldn't work. Because I was writing about me. I wasn't fictionalizing, really. And since then, it's become more and more the way I define myself. For the last 6 or 7 years, I've thought of myself primarily as a poet.
Do you have a kind of regime for writing, or is it a matter of whenever you have to survive that you write a poem?
No, I write every night, at least do free writing in a journal or a diary. It's sort of a way of creating a junk heap. And I was quite serious about saying the poems are explorations. I need to find out where I was that day, where I've moved to, how I've changed. Some of those will kind of accrete together like pins around a magnet. The lines start straightening out. They start echoing in your head. And those are the ones you work on over the weekend or when you get the chance. I do write at least once a week for several hours at a time. I need time to let my mind just play around for a long time when I won't be interrupted.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that given that your poems have been about yourself all this time, that as you've changed, your poems have changed?
Drastically. My early work is all metric. It's iambic pentameter. It very seldom faces up to what I would now consider the hard questions. It's very constrained. And I'm proud of having had the technique to write them that way, and I'm rather ashamed of not having the guts to break out of it. And as I've changed and started feeling freer with myself, freer to explore different areas of my experience, the form had to change. You simply can't write some of the later love poems or in that experience will not fit into form. Now I find I write about half the time in traditional forms, half the time in free verse, but in each case the content dictates the form, not the other way around.
Do you, in a way, rid yourself of feelings that you have had by, I'm thinking of poems about your mother, for instance. Is this a way of going back and saying things that you hadn't said before to her when she was there?
Yes, partly. Sometimes the poems end up being admissions of the fact that you can't rid yourself of feelings. I've got one called Card for My Mother's Birthday, which is a poem in which I finally face the fact that no matter how grown up I get, I'm not going to forgive her. And so that's a poem which, maybe it's not getting rid of those things, but accepting them back into yourself. You can look at them on the page and say, okay, I can live with that.
This is question two from Examinations, Old Horrors. Your mother, how did she die? Answer, alone, trailing feces and blood across the gray carpet, smearing herself over our lives, filling grandfather's clock with empty Four Roses bottles. Answer, I was lost myself, trying to find the ninth month of pregnancy, trying to think, what should I do when I did?
Most of my poems are about obsessives. either obsessive feelings or the things that haunt you, or the attempt you make and make and make and never succeeded and so on. What's important to me about the poem is that it be very accurate and honest about where exactly I am, what person I am now, and when, in terms of chronology, it happens is not important. Place can be important to me in the sense that what New England is like was important in my first book. There's been a change from the east to the west and then all the way to Alaska in my life, and that has had a kind of connection with a loosening of formal structure and with a willingness to take on new kinds of subjects also. I'm noticing now, I've just finished this book, most of it is about me, and I start wanting to write poems about vision and Arctic light and all sorts of absolutely impossible topics, and I haven't found out how to write them yet. But obviously something is changing again, only I don't know yet what.
What do you see as the function of your poetry, your present poetry, I guess, for people who read it?
I would hope, speaking with great chutzpah, that it would be not only the confessional interest in the history of someone else's life, but that at times, at least, it would explode into vision. This is the way I see things, yes, personally, but also this is a way of seeing things. There are these kinds of connections that can be made among people, between people and experience, and I want you to see them in this light. And at least try it on.
Do you have a particular poem that you think fits that?
The visionary?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's the last poem in the book. It's called The Lesson of John, and the title comes from the Book of Common Prayer. It's the story of John the Evangelist. You remember he was always being asked what he was doing out there? This was my attempt to answer it. I've incorporated lines from the Book of Common Prayer into the poem. And it's my attempt really to say, what are you doing being a poet? This is the lesson of John. The pen fits to the hand but skips over the page, leaving out, leaving a hole. The poet walks around the rim, poking, stirring debris with a stick, ignoring the tools which lie nearby,
ignoring the thin voice calling out, calling up, calling from earth to earth, talking of wilderness.
Almost anything can be avoided for a price. The price we pay for avoiding the holes is the circles we walk around them, the figure eights with which we cover the landscape, coming finally, dizzily to rest somewhere, trying to make sense of our tracks in the snow, and finding in every eight two possibilities of plunge for every one avoided. The landscape is littered with chasms until the pit we started from glows on the icy field, begins to be the place to be. But how to climb back, to tell foxhole from prophesying hole, how to keep the line breaks firm, I am not the Christ from I am not. And they asked him, art thou the prophet? And he answered, no. What art thou then? What sayst thou thyself? Back to the charred pit, bend to the shovel and sift for the answer. Better jump in, trusting like Dante's souls that some will have speech with you, even and particularly there, where speech grows from history to vision, completes the poem.
Wheat Among the Bones, a new book of poetry by Mary Barron. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Gold fever has hit again. Mining supply companies and land offices are deluged daily with calls from Alaskans, Texans, Oklahomans, and just about anybody who dreams of streets paved with gold. For folks with those fantasies, there are prospector supply houses that will help to outfit them with the necessary gear. Leah Madonna is the proprietor of Alaskan Prospectors and Geologists Supply in Fairbanks. They advertise that they carry everything for the prospector.
If a person wanted to get started just going after gold, what would they have to get?
I would suggest the first thing would be a gold pan and a shovel and maybe a small glass vial to hold the gold in that they're hopeful of getting.
There seem to be different kinds of gold pans. Now, what are those different kinds of gold pans, and does one get gold better than the other?
No, it's a matter of individual preference. The plastic gold pans are good, and so are the steel gold pans. But it's really a matter of some of the old-timers won't use a pan with riffles, which are little ridges along the pan. Others just swear by them. So it's just a matter of what a person feels comfortable with, and you don't have to use the biggest pan in the world to get the gold. A little one will do the same thing. If I were going in the field a long time, I would take a steel pan because it wouldn't take any chance of breaking it. Besides, I could always cook a fish in it, but you can't do that in plastic.
Now, a shovel, does it have to be a special kind of shovel, or any old shovel do?
Most people seem to prefer just a small, like a little GI shovel, something that they can pack into their pack easily and not take up a lot of space and weight.
The total investment for the pan, the shovel, and the glass vial comes to less than $10.
Now, I assume this is either for the person that likes the old-timey image or has no great hopes of really striking it rich. How about the person that wants a little bit more? What would they have to have?
Well, after they get that first speck of gold, then they start getting the bigger dream. It's sort of gold fever. So you progress from the gold pan generally into a hand-fed sluice box. That's the next step because you can still fasten that onto your backpack. A hand-fed sluice box generally is about 36 inches long, about 8 inches wide. And it's an item that you can place directly in the stream and shovel into it. So you relieve yourself of a little of the work. And the gold hangs up in the riffles, which are crossbars coming into that sluice box. And they're trapped in a carpet.
So we've got this hand-fed sluice box and weighs, let's see, 10 pounds or so, maybe.
Probably under that, right.
Yeah. And suddenly, boy, there's a lot of stuff settling out in those riffles. What next?
Okay, the real thing I hate to tell you about is the fact that whether you're using a simple gold pan, a simple little sluice box, or a great big suction dredge, even a miner's big blocks, big sluice, you know, in a mining operation, the end result is the gold pan. You have to revert back to the gold pan and pan out those fines. There's no other way to get them. There's no secret super way to ignore panning in the end. You clean out in a sluice box, you clean out the riffles in the carpet, rinse the carpet out in a tub, then you dump everything back into a pan and you pan it down.
Let's go to bigger dreams. Person has the gold pan,
has the little portable sluice box, and they want, boy, do we want to get that stuff out of there.
The next step in getting into recreational prospecting or the lure of gold would be the gold dredge. And suction dredges are available in anything from a 2.5-inch to an 8-inch dredge.
For recreational gold prospecting, Madonna recommended the 2.5-incher. That's the diameter of the hose. We looked at a 4-inch model. It was approximately 5 feet long and was rated to move 12 cubic yards an hour. But up here, it wouldn't move that much because she said we don't have perfect sand.
That particular dredge weighs 185 pounds. It probably would have a 90 to 95% recovery on any gold that would be running through it. It's still in a recreation classification.
That recreational dredge cost a bit over $1,100. Repayable with those first couple of ounces at the current rates.
Not everyone's going to be that fortunate. We have to remember the 1800s and the gold rush at that time. Out of every 1,000 that came, probably a couple of them made it, and it would be the same today.
Although not everyone is going to be that fortunate, there are lots of people trying. Business at Alaskan Prospectors and Geologists Supply is booming.
This year in particular, there are mornings that you have 3 or 4 trucks waiting at the gate before you even get the door unlocked. And, of course, the phone starts about 7 in the morning, calling from all over the country. It is a busy year.
More so than past years.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely insane this year. At 50 to 60 below in Fairbanks in January, I was knee-deep in customers, and normally a little store like this is just, you're startled to see someone come in January.
Are people going out and mining now?
In some areas where they can get in, and a lot of people are taking their equipment in by snow machine and sledding it in so that they have it in place. The average person that I see wants something they can use on the weekends in the summer. It might be a doctor, a lawyer, it might be a construction guy, might be a lady and her children that just want to get out, maybe get a little gold and have some fun. It's another excuse to get outdoors. But we also have the dreamer who thinks I'll start with a 6 or 8-inch dredge. I'm going to have a big mining operation before it's over.
Madonna herself is a recreational prospector of the gold pan and shovel variety. She enjoys driving the park's highway between Fairbanks and Anchorage and stopping at streams along the way. You successful?
Oh, well, I'm not going to tell you too much. Sometimes I'm successful, and sometimes I just get a lot of interesting rock material.
This summer, it's a sure bet there will be lots of people with pans, shovels, sluice boxes, and dredges looking for some interesting rock material. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
At the time, will be 12:24 1/4.
You may have been wondering what is happening with the time lately. We, at time of day, frankly have difficulty understanding it ourselves. Every second, every 60 seconds, a minute different. Every 60 minutes, another hour. 24 hours, or 1,440 minutes, another day, and that's 86,400 seconds in a day. And you wonder why we sound so insipid when you call time of day? Well, you just try it. And try it in a state with 4 time zones. So what if it's bigger than Texas? Does that mean it has to be more? Now, does it? 86,000 seconds a day times 4 time zones, and you have 344,000 times a day for time of day. And all you have to do is dial 411. We have to sound funny. And now there's talk, and we all know that talk is cheap, about changing the time zones. Yukon time. What is this, Robert Service? As Laurie Roberts has so often, too often, told us, not even the Yukon has Yukon time. But it seems now Juneau and Anchorage may add to the confusion. Why not change the name of the state? The Yukon. But that's been used before. Or maybe we could offer the Yukon Territory Alaska time. Not even Alaska has Alaska time. Though we at time of day always have time to tell you, regardless of your time zone, the time of day. Maybe we could pretend this is California, have an earthquake, eliminate a couple of time zones, and call it a day. For time of day, this is Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
At the time will be 12:24 3/4.
There was a 5-day Alaska Native Basketry Workshop in Anchorage last week. 5 expert basket makers from around the state served as teachers for the approximately 40 registered students.
The five teachers were Evelyn Douglas of Hooper Bay, teaching Eskimo grass basketry, Belle Deacon of Grayling, who concentrated on willow root trays, mother and daughter Selena Peratrovich and Dolores Churchill of Ketchikan, showing Haida cedar bark baskets, and Eunice Neseth of Kodiak, who taught Attu basket making. Most learned by watching relatives, though Eunice Neseth was instructed by a basket maker from Unalaska, who periodically traveled to Kodiak to offer instruction. For 26 years, she has been making Attu baskets, extremely fine, small woven pieces that look almost like silk, and like someone with fingers far smaller than an adult would have to weave the grasses. Although the students in the basketry workshop were spared the task of collecting the materials used for basket making, their teachers must do it on a yearly basis, gathering enough bark, roots, or grasses to last until the proper time the next year. For some, it is a family event or an occasion for a picnic with other basket makers, especially when there is some distance to travel. In Kodiak, according to Eunice Neseth, cutting the grasses she uses is not so difficult, but it is time-consuming.
We use the beach grass and get it in Kodiak. It grows all along the Alaska coast or even down in the States. They say even on the eastern coast. It is a shore grass.
What time of year do you collect the grass?
We get a grass in June when it's just ready to head. We watch very closely at that time because it's growing fast and it'll be past the best stage quickly if we're not watchful. We gather this grass very carefully, straw by straw, and then put it, it's not straw by straw, really, it's a sheaf by sheaf. Then we put we wrap burlap around it, put it in a dark place for 10 days, and after 10 days it's ready to be separated out of its outer straws. We discard the outer straws as far as the two inner ones, and we save, that's all we save. Then the very innermost work of the straws is the one that you see on the outside of a solid woven basket.
The only other material used in making an Attu grass basket is embroidery thread for an outside optional decoration, or it may be woven in as a line. Collecting the red and yellow cedar bark for Haida and Simpson baskets is more physical than collecting the beach grasses. For elderly Selena Peratrovich and her daughter Dolores Churchill of Ketchikan, the early spring bark gathering is a family event. Dolores describes the process.
What we do when we get the red and yellow cedar is she comes, it's mountainous, but she still comes along with us and selects a tree because she wants the type of material that you get all depends on the kind of tree you get. So she picks one that is about 12 inches in diameter. Then we go really close to the base of the tree. We make a cut and take a strip that's about 5 inches wide, and we start pulling on it. You work it loose and then you pull it up. Because it has a grain to it, it goes straight up. And most of the trees that she picks are really high, like anywhere from 15 to 20 to 30 feet high. And because it has a grain to it, it goes straight up and it's not going to come off the tree unless you do something different. So you walk to one side and you whip it, and then you walk to the other side and you whip it to that side.
Sometimes grandchildren are encouraged to climb up and do the whipping. If they fall, the ground is mossy and the landing is soft. After the bark is removed from the cedar trees, master basket maker Selena takes over.
And then I come home and then
I split the white one. I split and then I hung it for a while, not all night. I bundle and then I put it away. I tight the trunk or can, garbage can tight. I keep it even it's... He keep it and then it looks like it's fresh, you know. He never keep it tight and then it turns to look like it's old. That's why us keep it tight. And then now us it through. And then I walk on that yellow cedar. Whole winter us is, he hung it in upstairs, in my upstairs. Whole winter. This pit dry and then I split. And then I split, and then next I split fine, and then I scrape it, I scrape it, I wash it, I scrape it, and then I split fine now.
The technique used for Attu baskets and the Haida cedar bark baskets is much the same, though the size of the material differs. A cedar basket has a looser feeling. The split bark is perhaps 3/16 of an inch wide, as opposed to the fine, stripped grasses used in the Attu work.
Bundles of the fine beach grass are also used in making Yupik Eskimo grass baskets, though the technique differs from the Attu and Haida bark weaving technique. Bundles of grasses are coiled around and sewn together with a single grass thread. Since most of the women in Hooper Bay make the baskets, they tend to go out in groups to harvest the material.
Every fall, women, they go down to the beach and they pick them from the sand dunes. You know, they go right along the beach and, well, you have to wait till they turn white, you know, fall time. And after that, the women take them home and hang them up to dry in the house.
What's the weather like when you go out picking those grasses?
It's cold. You know, you have to wear parkas and gloves and, well, it gets cold fall time, you know. And you have to walk all the way down to the beach. And
how far?
It's about 2 miles from the village. Yeah, but there's a road going down to the beach. There's an airport down there.
Do men and women both go, or just women?
Men think that it's women's job, so women do it all the time.
Basket making is generally considered women's work, with the exception of baleen basket making in Barrow and Point Hope, where men work with the long black strainers from the mouth of the bowhead whale. However, in some parts of the state, men are quite involved in collecting the bark and roots. In the interior, it may be necessary to travel long distances to look for suitable cut banks for tree roots. Then it's a camping trip, and men usually go along. Belle Deacon collects willow roots along the cut banks of the Yukon River after spring breakup. Usually she waits until late summer to do the collecting, though the timing isn't critical. If no roots are sticking out of the cut bank, then she has to dig for them.
It's hard to work to get that. Lots of work and too much mosquitoes summertime.
How far do you have to go to get those?
Well, last summer I went 50 miles below Caltech. We camped 3 nights out. We gathered these roots. We burned lots of gas. And the gas is getting too high now.
The time and effort involved in collecting materials for basketry, and in some cases the cost of transportation too, though significant, add only a small amount to the prices charged for the finished work. Although Belle Deacon, now 74, has raised her prices in the last 5 or 6 years, partly due to other people's encouragement to do so, none of the basket makers at the workshop last week felt that they could really charge what their work and time might be worth, or there would be no sales. And then Belle Deacon, Eunice Nesseth, Evelyn Douglas, Selena Paratrovich, and Dolores Churchill all have a special feeling toward what they do, and it's the satisfaction of their art rather than what they get paid for it that keeps them going, spending hours and days collecting grasses and bark and roots, preparing the materials, and doing the fine work of making the baskets. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.